Hello, I'm Bonnie Burkert, and this is Truth Be Told, Transformation, sharing tools for transformation so you can live your highest truth. So what's transformative about Yule, this time of year? So I like to feel the deepness of the season, and I really like to reflect on how the light is diminishing and yet it returns. And that's what we'll be talking about today, the celebration of the return of light at this time of year in the Northern Hemisphere. With that, to do so, I'd like to introduce special guest Jason Mankey. Hi, Jason.
Hi, Bonnie. Thank you for having me. I'm really excited to be here.
Cheers. Thanks so much. I one of my favorite subjects, Yule. So what does the word Yule mean? Where do we, help me understand Yule as it compares to Christmas, as it compares to the solstice?
Yule's pretty complicated in some ways because we use it in three different ways.
Okay.
So the ancient Norse and Germanic peoples had a holiday that they called Yule. We don't know as much about it as we might like. When we think of Yule, we just think of a day, but it seems like the Norse celebrated it over a period of time. So some people think they might have celebrated it from the middle of November to the middle of January. So 2 months. Some people think it was maybe just a couple of weeks long. But however long they celebrated it at the kind of the start of official winter. And the climax, sort of the high point of it, was the winter solstice. So they were celebrating the return of the light. They were also celebrating a time of abundance. In December, you can keep meat cold because you have to slaughter your herds in November because you can't keep a whole lot of extra things around when there's no food to feed them. So there's plentiful meat. And about that time of year, too, all of the beer that you've been brewing is ready to drink. So it's a very fun time of year because you have all of this extra food and all of this extra booze. And the Norse and Germanic peoples really celebrated those things. And their Yule celebrations were about eating. Especially they liked big pork dinners. It was about drinking. It was also about telling ghost stories, something that we don't really associate with Yule anymore.
No.
Eventually, once that area became Christianized, Yule became a synonym for Christmas. And in a lot of places, Yule and Christmas are the same thing. So if somebody says Happy Yule, they could really just be wishing you a Merry Christmas. And then there's the term Yule used by modern pagans and witches and other magical folks to signify specifically the winter solstice. That's not how the Norse necessarily would have used it, but it's how it's used often today. And when witches and pagans celebrate the winter solstice, they're celebrating the return of the light after the shortest day. Some people see sort of an allegory for what we call the wheel of the year, the turning of the seasons, and they see deities being born and died during that time. And sometimes they celebrate the rebirth of a solar deity on the winter solstice. Sometimes it's just an excuse to make merry, kind of like the ancient Norse did. So there's a lot of different facets to how the word Yule can be used.
Fantastic. Well, that's great. And Jason is an expert on this as the author of a book called Llewellyn's Little Book of Yule. So we'll make sure that you... There you go. Thank you, Tony Sweet, who's manning the controls here, making sure that we've got a look at that title. And let's go back even further because... Jason, when you're talking about some of these traditions, help me with the timing. Like how old might we be discussing some of the information that you know?
So the winter solstice might be the oldest holiday that we celebrate as human beings. Scholars think that celebrations of the winter solstice go back maybe 10,000 years, which is a very long time. That's the Stone Age. That, you know, that is ancient history. The earliest sort of like celestial observatory that really marked the winter solstice and monument is the Gosbeck Circle, which is found in Germany, and that's 7,000 years old. Newgrange in Ireland is about 3,500 years old. That's pretty well known. It's a chamber, and on the winter solstice, on just that day, the inner chamber fills with light because it's been aligned a particular way. And monuments like Stonehenge, which dates about 3,200 BCE, that is also aligned with the winter solstice. So a long time, people have been celebrating that particular time of year. But there's a couple of other holidays that were celebrated in the ancient world that have had a direct impact on how we celebrate holidays like Christmas and then sort of Yule as modern witches and pagans celebrate it. And the biggest one is the Saturnalia, which was a Roman celebration celebrated from about the 16th of December through the 23rd of December. So it was a week-long celebration. And during that celebration, the Romans did a lot with what the Norse and Germanic people did when they were celebrating their Yule. They ate a lot and they drank a lot, but they also decorated with evergreen branches, holly and ivy, mistletoe. They sang carols and was pretty raucous. There was also a holiday just after that known as the January Calends. So it was sort of an extended holiday season between those two different holidays. And that was the start eventually of the Roman New Year. And it was a time to give gifts and it was a time to decorate with all of those things that they had been decorating with. So, you know, it was big, it was fun. And a lot of the trappings of modern day Christmas come directly from the Roman Saturnalia.
It's incredible. I mean, it's so clear. If there was any question about the pagan origins of Christmas, I mean, you were basically laying it all out there for us. I mean, right down to the holly.
Yeah, I mean, I want to be fair, though. Those are the things that are green that time of year. So, I mean, it makes sense is that that's what you decorate with. And a lot of those people who became Christians were pagans the week before. And it's hard to take away the things that you love, right? So you want to continue to decorate with the things that you like. But yes, anyone who says that Jesus is the sole reason for the season, that's usually a step too far. There's a lot of different elements this time of year.
Don't you like the play, The Son, right? Jesus is the Son of God. Is that S-O-N or S-U-N?
For me, that's always been really important because I like seeing my beliefs sort of echoed in other things. You know, like everybody's celebrating the Son. You just have to choose which vowel you want to use.
Right? Yeah, exactly. So you want to tell me a little bit more about ancient Rome? I mean, Saturn, is there a harvest component to that? I mean, you're definitely talking about the harvesting of the meat, for example, mm-hmm. northern, but Rome was further south. So do you have any info on that out of curiosity?
So Saturn is sort of the Roman god of agriculture in a lot of ways. He lines up with the Greek Kronos, but the Romans gave him a much bigger role, and he was a god of agriculture. So it is, to some extent, also an agricultural holiday because you're celebrating the bounty of all the harvest around you and stuff. And it's true, they do, you know, gather crops a little bit later because they're a bit more southern. So yeah, there's that part of it too. One of my favorite parts, though, of the Roman Saturnalia is an idea called misrule, which has also been passed down throughout the last 20 centuries or so. And misrule was about subverting the social order. It was about being able to get away with things that you normally wouldn't get away with, which is always fun. And if you think about things that we do today, like office Christmas parties and raucous New Year's Eve parties, to me that's sort of a direct descendant of misrule.
That's
so one of the things about misrule was if you were a slave owner, and talking about slavery is kind of abhorrent, but the Roman Empire was built on that. But if you were a slave owner during the Saturnalia, you would serve your slaves food and they would get to be the masters of the house to some extent during this period. There's a letter that says, you know, everyone shall eat of the same meat and drink of the same drink, and it shall all be good, and none shall like hide the good wine. It will be given to everybody there, which is really different, right? I mean, that's like a special, crazy time of year. It was also a time for cross-dressing. I know this has nothing to do with the harvest, but I just wanted to make sure that I got all of this in because I think it's so interesting.
Absolutely. I mean, it's really funny with the costume aspect because I've always thought to myself, why aren't there Christmas holiday, Yule holiday costume parties? Because there's so many different characters. And, right? I mean, think about it. So I don't know. I think that might be a trend we have to start. You handle the Northern California, I'll handle Southern California, and we'll take it from there.
You know, there is actually a big tradition of dressing up, though. And, I mean, it's not exactly like our Halloween dressing up, but there's a long tradition of dressing up during the winter solstice and during Saturnalia and Yuletide festivities. One of those is mumming. Sometimes people who would mum would dress as animals. And in the medieval times would go door to door seeking food and drink. In Philadelphia today on January 6th, the world's largest mummers parade happens. And it looks very much like Mardi Gras in New Orleans. And it's likely that Mardi Gras is sort of an echo of some of these older Christmas traditions, just moved back a little bit. But at Philadelphia's giant mummer celebration, they wear these beautiful costumes. Thousands of people march in this parade that takes several hours to go through the city. And it's something that people should know about, yet like outside of Philadelphia, it's kind of an unknown, and it's this huge thing. And in Newfoundland, Canada, they still dress up around Christmas, and they wear, like, you wear your spouse's clothes or your parents' clothes, and you put like a sheet over your head, and you go door to door. It's called mumming, and you knock on your neighbor's door, and your neighbor invites you in, and the neighbor has to guess who you are by asking questions. And the people don't use their normal voices. They kind of talk funny, like, hello, like that, which is frightening. You can see pictures of people in these costumes, and they are kind of scary. But it's a long tradition there that they've done for a couple hundred years, though it was outlawed at one point because people would go into the house dressed in their mumming costumes, and then they would rob people. So it kind of got a little violent there for a while, but now it's much better.
Oh, some people just ruining it for the rest of us.
That's
mumming.
True.
I mean, mumming needs to happen. It's almost like a second Halloween.
It is. And Halloween, like the trick or treat and all that might actually be an echo of Christmas. Like we always think of trick or treating as, oh, it's something that only ever happens at Halloween. Up until the 1920s in New York City, people used to go trick or treating on Thanksgiving and would dress up. And that only went away because the Macy's Thanksgiving Day was so popular and the trick or treating really couldn't keep up with it. So it's very likely that all of these holidays like share set things and, you know, steal from bits and pieces here and there.
Indeed. So I think this is a great segue to one of my favorite Christmas characters, Krampus.
Oh, yes.
Yes.
I love the Krampus. And he's really kind of going under this huge revival right now. There's really newfound interest in Krampus after sort of being an afterthought for quite a while. The Krampus, it's hard to say how old the Krampus actually is. I think the first written like mention of the Krampus only dates from the 1500s. I know a lot of people always want it to be some sort of ancient pagan thing, and it very well might be. I mean, there's certainly not much Bible in that picture right there.
Right.
but the sort of origins of the Krampus are really unknown. It could be something having to do with the mummers, because people were dressed up in animal skins and dressed as animals, and the Krampus isn't very far from that. No matter where it comes from, though, the Krampus's role is really fascinating to me. You know, you had St. Nicholas as a gift giver, and so St. Nicholas is mostly nice. But children also need a deterrent to be bad from being bad, and the Krampus was the deterrent from being bad. And on the night before St. Nicholas night, which we call now Krampus, or the night before St. Nicholas Day, which is Krampus night, December 5th, the Krampus would go from door to door in places in Germany and Bavaria and Croatia, just kind of like some various spots in Europe. And he would check on the children to see if they've been good. And, you know, he carried a switch, and corporal punishment was something that the children were afraid of with the Krampus. There are images of him with a basket on his back. And the idea was if a child was really bad, Krampus would throw them in the basket and whisk them away to hell. I have a friend who is from Croatia, and she's told me that she grew up in fear of the Krampus. Like, she dreaded Christmas time because she was worried the Krampus was going to come and get her.
Well, Jason, I want to interject because I can relate to that. And the reason I happen to pronounce it Krampus is because I grew up in Austria, and our first Christmas there, on December 5th, Krampus came to our apartment door, and my mom she just thought this was funny, and what's this tradition? And he was asking, are there any bad children here? And mom's like, oh, yes, she's very, very bad. And I got switched.
Oh, wow. Were you bad?
Of course. But my mom was sad. She said, no, she's not that bad. She thought it was a funny joke. But little did we know. And so we always would, you know, lock the doors forevermore on December 5th. So it's crazy how it's endured. And I mean, that was quite a long time ago. I won't give you any particular years, but it's out there. And one of the things I'd like to ask you about, because I've had a chance to look at it, I think, you know, sort of exploring my childhood trauma with this Christmas devil, is the horns, and I think you mentioned a Christmas goat in some of your other writings.
Yeah.
There is something really fascinating to see the tribal aspect of this. And if you look at, I don't know, the masks from other parts of the world, Africa, Indonesia, you're seeing some similarities that are quite interesting to see some of that old tribal look art in Northern Europe that is not dissimilar from other continents. So I just wanted to ask your thoughts on the horns and the tribal.
I'm a big fan of horns. You know, I mean, a lot of people see horns and they instantly think devil and they think bad, but I see horns and I see connection to the natural world with creatures like goats and antlers on deer. I always see them as a very positive thing.
Yeah, they're beautiful. And
so there were people who believed that Krampus, for instance, lived like out in the woods away from society, kind of like a wild animal, right? Kind of like a creature. I also think human beings, even when we are, you know, separated by thousands of miles, there's something that unites us as human beings. And these ideas come to us independently, and then we put them in our art or put them in things. And there's always, I think, more cross-pollination too between societies than people think. You know, we know that people would go on pilgrimages for over 1,000 miles during the Stone Age. So people were not as secluded as we sometimes think they are.
Very good point. So, again, this was, there was a harvest component to all of the celebrating that was going on. And was Krampus tied in any way to, I mentioned the goat earlier, the Christmas goat? Is there a part of it? I mean, what do you think? How do you think the horns tie into people sort of deciding to use that as part of the costume?
If you think about horned and antlered animals, they're really important for our survival as human beings. You know, people eat antlered and horned animals for food. Goats, of course, really important. They were, you know, they're a semi-domesticated creature that we use for cheese and meat and milk. So, you know, it would make sense that people would want to honor these types of animals more than other types of animals, just because survival was predicated on them being there and existing. The Yule goat is a really fascinating thing. It's Scandinavian, so it's a little bit further north. And the Yule goat, there's a couple of different versions of the Yule goat. One of them is sort of a human being with like goat horns and stuff. Doesn't quite look like Krampus. It's much, much more goat-like. It's very definitively a goat man. But the god Thor had a chariot pulled by goats. Some people think that the Yule goat might be related to Thor's goats. There's also a tradition of straw Yule goats, and this is the one that you see most often today. Sometimes they'll build some that are several stories tall, maybe not made out of traditional straw, but to look like that. And there's an old tradition of like going into your neighbor's house and hiding a Yule goat somewhere in their house, and then once you find it, you have to go hide it in your neighbor's house. I think I would be a little horrified if I found a random Yule goat in my house that my wife had not put there. I'd be a little worried about breaking and entering, perhaps. But it is a tradition there. You know, and again, I just think it's the kind of animal that you want to honor, that you need to honor, because it's important to your survival.
Yeah, that's a great way of looking at it. But meanwhile, the Krampus, as you did I pronounce it how you're saying it? I only know.
I'm sure that I am using like a terrible English version of the word, and that you're the one saying it properly.
Krampus. Did you know that there is a Krampus ball here in Los Angeles now?
Mm-hmm. I keep trying to let my wife I want my wife to let me go. Is really what it's about.
No, it's big. I mean, it's kind of fascinating to see that. So let's talk about some other traditions. How about the tree, the Christmas tree? You mentioned evergreen boughs. So I'm sure there's all kinds of stories around that. And
That's another thing that's really kind of hard to untangle. We know that the Romans and the Norse both decorated with evergreen branches. So those have been a part of holiday celebrations now for over 2,000 years. So that's pretty long, well established. What doesn't seem likely is that they cut down whole trees and brought those inside, though there is a 4th century mosaic showing Dionysus entering a Saturnalia celebration with a very skinny pine tree. Some people have said maybe he was bringing the first Yuletide tree to a party. Maybe that's possible, I guess. It's more likely that they sort of evolved out of a couple of other things. The first is you're already decorating with branches. Why not just cut down the whole tree and bring it inside? And then there's this idea of a paradise tree as sort of bringing the Christmas tree to life. The paradise tree was something that was popular in the Middle Ages. And on December 24th, people celebrated the feast day of Adam and Eve. And they would bring in a tree, usually a pine tree, and they would put apples on it. And this was supposed to represent the tree of knowledge in the Garden of Eden. So the next day on Christmas, that tree would still be there. So people kind of got used to just seeing that tree there, and they think that might be where the Christmas tree comes from. Another idea is that it comes from a Germanic tradition of the Christmas pyramid. Today, Christmas pyramids have kind of like scenes from nativities and stuff. But originally, it was just kind of a pyramid, and it had evergreen boughs on it, and it had maybe some holly and some other things. And then they would hang it, and eventually maybe that transformed into a Christmas tree. The story that you hear most often is Martin Luther, the founder of the Protestant Reformation, was the first one to build a Christmas tree. And he decided instead of just decorating with pine boughs, he would knock down a whole tree, and then he would put candles on it, which, you know, sounds like a disaster waiting to happen.
Especially as Californians, indeed.
Yeah, yes, especially.
I actually had that one Christmas in Germany. I remember I was really scared, like, oh no, I hope it doesn't burn, but I'll never forget how beautiful it was.
Yeah, apparently they only kept the candles lit for a couple of seconds because they realized how bad it was.
Yeah.
But like maybe on Christmas morning with the family gathered around, you'd light all the candles, look at it for half a second, and then immediately
and then
blow
quickly
it out.
Hey, I want to contribute something that I heard about Christmas trees, and you can give me your opinion. I heard that people, because people were already having to be, it's been cold for a while, and they were indoors, and things were starting to get stuffy, they brought trees in, and there was that evergreen freshness that helped keep things pure. It was like a purification aromatherapy play in people's homes at that time. I don't know.
I've never heard that. That's like actually pretty brilliant. I mean, that's why I still have a fresh cut tree, just because it smells so damn good. You know?
Exactly. So, yeah. I mean, it's interesting to reflect on that, you know, the many different potentially, you know, reasons why it happened. And I have another contribution. I heard that the tradition of going around people's homes and giving gifts, you know, not, you know, visiting your friends and family, that they would need to do that and go check on each other just to make sure they hadn't frozen or they had were, you know, making sure that they had enough food, or maybe you had a little bit of extra food, or you could trade some potatoes for some dried meat or something like that. So
I think one of the things we often sort of overlook when it comes to Yuletide celebrations is they always seem very festive and fun. If you look at the Roman Saturnalia, it looks fun. Norse Yule, sitting in a mead hall all day drinking mead, eating ham, that doesn't sound terrible. But winter is a scary time for people because it's easy to get snowed in. It's easy to be cut off from everybody else. So why not use an excuse to check in on people? Absolutely.
I know, it's a beautiful way to look at it. And I want to say, you know, when you're talking about the scary time of the year, and I don't know about you, but I really do take advantage of the darker days, the longer nights, and maybe going to bed a little bit earlier, or I don't know, using it. It's not that cold, but I pretend it is. You know, I live in LA. It's like, oh no, it's 55. I'm freezing. I can't go out. And I think that it's really a beautiful, restful time. And I can certainly relate to how exciting it must have been for them to see the days then, you know, knowing that after the 22nd or so, the days are slowly but surely getting longer.
I've always loved like the big social aspects of this time of year, but there's something really like, it's like a balm for the soul, the quiet.
Yeah.
Like if you go outside on December 20th, like, and it's cold, it's just even a little cold outside. You know, I live in Silicon Valley. It's not much better here. Like we don't get 20 degrees, but you know, you get 45 degrees, but everything is just kind of quiet and still and so dark, and it's a great time to look inward and think about where you've been in the last year and what you need to prepare for as the sun begins to grow in the sky. You know, I love this time of year because you've kind of got those two dual sides sort of competing. You've got that raucous history of Saturnalia, but then you have where we are in the wheel of the year, where we are with the lack of sunlight. And I think that causes us to look inward too.
No, I love that. That's great. No, and thanks for bringing that and sharing your thoughts on it and how it works. Because again, we like to share tools for transformation, as I said at the beginning of the show. And so I just want to let people know that if you feel like you do need a little extra sleep during the winter time or the late fall, because right, you know, it's not even winter yet, technically, listen to that and know that our forefathers definitely, they had to. They had no other choice. They needed to stay in. So we have not mentioned Santa Claus, Nick, and that magical man. What do you think about, what do we know about him?
I love Santa. I mean, I think Santa is probably the real reason for the season for a lot of people. There's a really real energy there with Santa. Santa, like most things this time of year, has a complicated history, and it comes from several different sources. You know, it's true that Santa Claus is based on St. Nicholas. We don't know much about St. Nicholas or even if he was really a real person. But during the Middle Ages, St. Nicholas, who was allegedly a saint from Turkey, he was the most popular of all the saints. After Mary, there was no one else that people prayed to more in medieval times than St. Nicholas. And in Paris, France, in the 12th century, children were demanding gifts and apparently were quite rude about it. And some nuns had this idea of like, what if we say to the children that if you're good, St. Nicholas will give you a present, and then we'll go and deliver presents. And lo and behold, that worked. So from then on, everyone began to expect presents from St. Nicholas because of what these nuns had did. And that tradition sort of spread across Europe. And to really the most important place that it spread was the Netherlands. And they took St. Nicholas and changed St. Nicholas. So if you look at old pictures of St. Nicholas, he looks like a Byzantine saint. He has mostly a short beard. He has brown hair. He looks nothing like Santa Claus. But in the Netherlands, all of a sudden, he has this long white beard. He's kind of got this long white hair. And not only does he give presents, he also rides a magical horse. And all of these things have a lot in common with the Norse god Odin, who was still a figure of folklore even after Christianity kind of came into that area. So a lot of people think that St. Nicholas and Odin kind of merged in some way and created this new figure of St. Nicholas as holiday gift giver. I'm one of them because of the appearances are just so blatantly obvious, and then the horse parallel and things. But he wasn't called Santa Claus yet. He was still St. Nicholas. In 1821, we have the first written version of the word Santa Claus. It's not two words, Santa and Claus. It just says Santa Claus. And it comes from a book called The Children's Friend. We don't really know who wrote and illustrated that book. But there's this little poem in there, and it talks about Santa visiting on Christmas Eve, and Santa's wearing a red and white suit, and he's got a sleigh with reindeer. And 2 years later, we get a poem called A Visit from St. Nicholas, which most of us know much better as The Night Before Christmas. And that really kind of sets the Santa myth in stone. All of a sudden, you've got 8 reindeer, maybe 9 later with Rudolph. But, you know, he's still wearing the red and white coat. His name is Santa Claus, spelled like we spell it today. You know, he's a right jolly old elf. And this figure, in a lot of ways, is very different than the Dutch St. Nicholas. So while you still had, while they still had their version of St. Nicholas, in a lot of places, Santa had become kind of feral and more wild. So he wore, sort of more rustic, trapper sort of coats and things instead of looking like a saint. And in the Americas, that's the version that really sort of won. Today, we've made it less rough looking. I mean, his red and white looks like a pretty nice suit. But anyway, so that poem made everybody in the United States not only want to celebrate Christmas, but children began to demand Santa as an expectation. And that only grew throughout the next few decades. in the 1860s and 1870s, you have a cartoonist living in New York City named Thomas Nast, who draws a lot of pictures of Santa Claus. He sort of decides that Santa's going to live at the North Pole. Santa's going to have a crystal ball so he could watch the children. A lot of things that we associate with Santa come from Thomas Nast. And then sort of modern depictions of Santa, sort of a less rugged looking figure, come from the Coca-Cola ads. The artist there, his last name is Sunbloom. He kind of made Santa a little bit taller than what he had been before. And that's really kind of how we get the modern Santa. So, you know, there's some Christian forces there. There's some pagan forces there. There's some capitalism there.
Right, exactly. Coca-Cola
secular
forces.
Stuff there.
That is fantastic. Have you ever heard the theory that Santa was a shaman?
That was a very popular theory. It started, I think, in the 60s, really became popular in the 80s. I don't think that it holds up. One of the arguments in there is the reindeer argument, that Siberian shamans had reindeer, and Santa didn't use reindeer until the 19th century.
Ah.
So, and then then there's also the argument about the red and white, because there's a mushroom that's red and white, and it
sure
does. It looks like a Christmas mushroom. That's for sure. But, Santa didn't dress that way for a long time. It's fascinating, though, and certainly there are people who link Odin with ancient shamanistic traditions. So perhaps, it's another one of the factors that have come into play in the creation of the Santa Claus figure.
Fabulous. I love it. Okay, so what else is in your book? Tell us one of the other chapters that we haven't touched on yet.
One of the things in the book, the last bit, is about holidays after Christmas. I think, especially in the United States, if you go to a department store on the 26th, like all the Christmas decorations are down, they're not playing Christmas carols anymore. The 12 days of Christmas started on Christmas, right? So now, like, we don't really do much other than New Year's Eve. But for a very long time, that period of time from the 25th through January 6th was a huge time for parties and celebrations. And it was just seen as Christmas. If you got a gift on 12th night, which was January 5th, which especially in England for a very long time was sort of the highlight of the holiday season, you would still call it a Christmas gift. There's a lot of lore still attached to New Year's. I like a lot of the eating lore about New Year's. I grew up in the American South, and we had a legend that if you ate black-eyed peas for dinner on New Year's Day, you would have good luck throughout the year.
Good to know.
Yeah, so there's a lot of variations on those kind of things. But I love the idea of holidays post-Christmas that celebrate this season, and I really miss that, I think, in the United States. And in a lot of places in Europe, still holidays like Epiphany, which is the day of the three wise men, is still a very, very big deal. And it has all those trappings we associate with holiday.
Indeed. Yeah, I had that experience down in Mexico, that Christmas Eve wasn't a big night of gift giving at all. I think the kids got one present, and it was a bigger deal on December, is it 6th, I think? January. January 6th. Yeah.
Even like into the end of the 19th century, presents on New Year's Day were really popular. Like the Queen, I think, of England, Victoria, was giving out presents on January 1st instead of Christmas. And that seems like, wow, that's not that long ago. Didn't everybody always do things exactly like we do them now? But the history of the holidays is always, there's all this ancient history, but it's continually adapting and changing too at the same time.
Hey, nothing wrong. I'm sure somebody just alert somebody to the idea of New Year's gifts. I'm sure there would be plenty of companies that wouldn't mind that happening.
When I was a child, we used to get gifts on New Year's. Like, we had this weird tradition where in my family, we believed as children that the baby New Year would come to your house on New Year's Eve and fill your shoes with presents. It was a baby, so they obviously had to be small. And I had never heard of this tradition outside of my family for a long time. And apparently it's something practiced in parts of Appalachia. And there's a couple of parts of Canada where there were a lot of Appalachian settlers who moved up to Canada where they still do that. There's not a whole lot of us who celebrate Baby New Year. But that one of the things is just strange to me is like, you know, you have these traditions that last for hundreds of years. Some of them become very popular and some of them, like the Manky baby New Year tradition, don't really catch
on. What about the baby and the cake? Right. So that the king cake, is that more that's going further into the season? That's more around the Mardi Gras time. Do you know that?
It was originally more of a Christmas thing for a very long time. A lot of it had to do with those ideas of misrule. So if you were the one who found whatever it was in the cake, whether it was a bean or a baby, like a little plastic baby, like it is at Mardi Gras now, you were supposed to be the one who presided over the festivities for that party. And, you know, Mardi Gras is fascinating because a lot of these things were originally associated with Christmas and then they kind of just got pushed later into the year. But there's a long history in parts of Europe of people eating things, like finding things in the food and then being put in charge of various festivities.
Yeah, right on. That happened to me. I got the baby one time. I don't know if I did a follow through. I think I owe somebody a New Year's party or something like that. So we're talking about the little Christ child, like the baby and the Christkindle. And one of the things I saw in your writings was, and I had seen that myself, interesting that the Christ child in representation in a lot of these festivals isn't really a baby. It's a pretty young gal. So equal opportunity.
Yeah, the Christ kind is one of my favorite weird pieces of holiday lore. It's another thing that has something to do with Martin Luther. So as a Protestant reformer, he didn't like St. Nicholas as a gift giver because he was Catholic. So we can't have St. Nicholas. I think, said Martin Luther, how about Jesus as a baby giving gifts? Okay, I guess that makes sense. So he decided that Jesus as a baby would be the gift giver. But they found out that it's hard to have a toddler or a baby do very much if you wanted to have a live representation of that figure doing things for the holidays. So because Jesus back then already had blonde hair, they thought, hey, what if we got one of the young ladies in town to kind of portray this figure? And over time, this baby Jesus became this angelic female figure, originally played by young women, probably between 12 and 15. Now, though, usually played by adults, and she kind of looks like a fairy princess with angel wings. In certain parts of Germany, that the Christ kind, which is where we get Kris Kringle, that figure is still more popular than Santa Claus. And the Pennsylvania Dutch, the Amish, also welcome the Christ kind into their homes on Christmas Eve, which I think is great. Chicago has a gigantic Christkindle market where the Christ kind is the centerpiece of everything. Like in department stores, it was always Santa. There it's her. And I think it's great that there is another female gift giver, you know, instead of just Santa. Italy has its own female gift giver too, the Befana, who is a Christmas witch. You know, depending on your version of the story, sometimes she becomes the Christmas witch out of bad things, and sometimes she becomes the Christmas witch because of good reasons. But however it is, she has pledged to go and give gifts to all of the children in the world on the night of January 5th. Originally, she was one of the gift givers on Epiphany. A lot of places now, she still gives presents on Christmas Eve, but originally it was a little bit later. There are stories that Jesus said to her, because she couldn't have children, you shall be the mother of all the Italian children and you shall give them gifts. And then other times there's stories where she lied to the three wise men and gave them bad directions to Bethlehem, even though they had the star, apparently. You know, she was still punished for that and then had to give gifts as penance. But she's another great one. And there's this renewed interest in figures like Befana and Krampus and the Christ kind and all of these magical gift givers. You know, you talk about transformation this time of year. This is a really magical time of year. This is the time of year where you're encouraged to believe in magic. You know, how often do we hear, it's a Christmas miracle? I've never heard anyone say, it's a Thanksgiving miracle, right? Where we believe in the miraculous this time of year more so than any other time. And what's more miraculous than a guy who goes around the world in 24 hours and hands out 8 billion presents to children? I mean, this is a really great time.
I love it. Jason, thank you. You really, I just know when I had a chance to start looking in the into the traditions and the history of Christmas, it really was a great perspective shift. And truly towards magic. I mean, towards paying attention to the changing of the seasons and all of that. And, you know, with it, just imagining our forefathers and what their experience must have been like. And you are really a font of knowledge. I mean, this is just fascinating. We really appreciate it. And let's show the book cover again, just for anybody that might like to explore this particular book and many, many others that Jason has written for Llewellyn. And thank you, Team Llewellyn, for sending Jason my way. You want to leave us with any last merry words?
You know, what I love most about this time of year is how universal it can be. There are so many different holidays that are happening right now. There are so many different things to celebrate. I mean, I know that things are still a little rough in the world, but this year we get to be with our loved ones. And I know for me, that's a big step up from last year. So enjoy the magic, enjoy the festivities of the season, and enjoy the darkness.
Fantastic. Thank you. Blessed Yule, Jason.
Yeah, blessed Yule. Happy holidays. Thank you so much. This was really fun.
Cheers, everybody. This is Bonnie Burkard here for Truth Retold Transformation. I'll remind you that we have a new episode Monday, Wednesdays, and Fridays, 3 p.m. goes live. You can see Robert Hensley with the Minuteman Report on Mondays and Tony Sweet, our fearless leader, on Fridays live at 3 p.m. So please share. Please let us know what you're thinking about all of this. And truly, it's been a big pleasure. So until the next time, have fun and be merry.